Let's, if we can, move into the book of Acts. If you have a Bible, you might want to turn to Acts 24 and 25. I know I have a couple visitors here, so let me just mention real quickly that one of the things we do in the class every single week is we go through some of the material that the church is encouraging us to go through. And right now, the various Bible fellowships are going through the book of Acts. I've gone through a little faster, so I'll leave a little time this summer to go on to some other topical issues. And today we find ourselves in chapters 24 and 25. We're going to look at Felix and Festus and Agrippa. But most importantly, then, the second half of what I like to do is take something that either applies to the message, you'll see that on your handout that says application, or we have some Ask Kirby questions. And this is kind of a conflated one. Since we're going to be talking about these Roman leaders, I'm going to answer one of the questions that comes up all the time, and that is, are we Rome? That is, do we see any parallels between the United States of America and Rome? This is a book written by Colin Murphy. I'll get into it a little bit later, which is one of the books that I'll mention. That's really a secular book. I'm also going to mention a Christian book, and I think it'll be kind of interesting to kind of think about the world that we find ourselves in. So if you enjoy history, we're going to cover a little of that. And it's amazing how many times I have people come up and say, you know, do you think we're like Rome? Do you think Rome is like us? Do you think we've become like that? And so we're going to try to answer those questions as well. So that will give you a little bit of a handout. And as you're looking at the handout right now, let's look at the bottom of the page. For those of you that are visitors, you'll see something that says PrestonwoodExamine.org. And that is a way in which you can find the material that I'm covering today. You can go to that website right now on your smartphone or tablet and follow along. Or if you find yourself wanting to look at this later, it's all available at the website, PrestonwoodExamine.org. We're going to look at believers have the opportunity to display the gospel. We're going to look at the Apostle Paul fairly quickly. And here we see some chapters which, again, talk about opportunities that Paul had to defend himself against these unfounded accusations coming from the Jews. And you know, each time they press some of these charges, he's committed to speak truthfully. And in the same time, not only does he proclaim his innocence, but also uses these opportunities to share the gospel. And so again, we can see that sometimes we get into difficult circumstances. Sometimes we find ourselves with opportunities. And here, Paul uses those opportunities to advance the kingdom. And so in chapter 24, we see that Paul has been taken prisoner and he is taken to Caesarea. And 2 weeks ago, I gave you some pictures of what Caesarea looks like. It's a Roman outpost. And so now he is going to actually give his defense before the Roman governor there by the name of Felix. And first of all, you have these accusations. You can see this in the first couple of verses here where they begin in verse 2 and following to list what they consider to be the charges. And then by the time we get to verse 10, we then see Paul's response. And of course, they argue that he was the source of a riot. As I point up on the screen there, you can see he was never really a source of the riot. They just simply did not like his teachings and blamed him for that. And they claim that he was profaning the temple, which, as we read just a few weeks ago, was just the opposite. He was there going under what a Jew would go to ritual purification. And so that's the first thing. And so Paul is, by the time we get to verse 10, then allowed to give a defense against these false accusations. And of course, he does that, as I point out, with dignity and clarity. He could have attacked the individuals. He does not. He could have brought up all sorts of false charges, but does not. But if nothing else, it really, again, helps us understand that he does this with a level of integrity. And by now, of course, we've read through 23 chapters in the book of Acts. And about 15 of those relate to Paul, and we can see that he has handled himself in a place of integrity. And so I think what you see here is Luke really highlights how unfairly Paul is being treated, because if nothing else, those people bringing accusations should not have actually brought a false witness. So I put up Exodus 20:1-7. You're not to bear false testimony, and that's exactly what they have indeed done. So then we see that he recounts some some of the events of the previous weeks. And again, these can be validated by everybody in attendance, because not only do you have the accusers coming to Caesarea, but you have some of those who support Paul coming there as well. And he again reaffirms his clear conscience. And perhaps one of the most famous verses you can see in verse 16. Look at verse 16. Because Paul says, I always take pains to have a clear conscience towards both God and man. And today we had, I think, an outstanding message by Pastor Graham. And remember, at one point he said, you know, have a clear conscience. You have a clear conscience by really taking seriously what you have in your refrigerator. When he first said refrigerator, I said, where is he going with refrigerator? Oh, no, not, don't tell me I can't have one of my snacks. Then I realized he was talking about alcohol. But for a second, I thought, how does the refrigerator relate to this? But anyway, he takes us to the refrigerator. He takes us to our computers. He takes us to our homes and reminds us of this very important passage, verse 16, that Paul always attempted and endeavored to have a clear conscience before God and men. And I think that's our application verse out of this chapter. We should do the same. And then, of course, he also accuses them of the statement which they make in a false manner. Then, what is so interesting is now, as you get to the very end of the chapter, in kind of a burst of inspiration, he comes back to something he had done when we had the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and points out the resurrection. He did that when he was in front of them because he knew that they would be divided. The Pharisees believed in a resurrection, the Sadducees did not, and the moment they heard that word, they start fighting amongst themselves. Well, now he uses this as a resurrection content gospel message as individuals are listening to this. And we'll really never know this side of heaven how many individuals who, as they heard Paul, whether in front of Felix or Festus or Agrippa, become Christians. Matter of fact, as we're going to see in just a minute, there is a sense in which it's quite possible that Felix wanted to hear a little bit more, and at the point did not commit himself to Christ. But who knows, maybe later on he did, you know, and so it's kind of interesting to see that. But anyway, he knows what angers these men most in the preaching about Jesus. But again, notice how he uses the gospel. A lot of people say, well, should I get involved politically? Well, Paul gets pretty political if you think about this, because he used the fact that he was a Roman citizen. He used the fact that he was unfairly condemned to do what? To present the gospel before rulers and kings. That's pretty amazing to see how he used that in an effective way. And then from verses 22 and following, we have this section here, which is kind of interesting, because we see Paul is confident. And we see that in some respects his words match the account that we see there. But what's interesting is that then Felix ends the hearing. But for a moment there, it's kind of interesting because it shows that while he does continue to provide proper care for Paul, according to legal customs, he's unwilling to dismiss these unfounded accusations. And if nothing else, we learn something else about some of these Roman rulers. Sometimes when you see these stories about Rome, we see these very vindictive, angry, confident rulers. But here you've got to recognize that even though Rome is occupying this area, which we call Israel, they also know that they're outnumbered, and they also know that they have to try to keep any kind of tension and riots down. So you see, in some respects, politicians acting like politicians, right? Here, there's no reason that he should keep Paul in custody, but he does. Simply so that he does not have to deal with the anger from those Jewish leaders. But then we see something else, and that is verse 24, that Felix and his wife Drusilla actually call for a private meeting with Paul. And I think they're kind of intrigued about some of this. After all, Drusilla is Jewish, so maybe they want to know a little bit more about this gospel of Jesus, or the people of the way, as they were called. They came to be known as Christians. But it turns out that goes well until he starts talking about sin and repentance, and that becomes a deal breaker. Have you ever noticed that before? You share the gospel, you talk about, you know, God has a wonderful plan for your life, and everybody goes, oh, okay, I'm glad to hear about that. You need to confess your sins. Oh, okay, that's a deal breaker. And this is exactly what happens here, is that now they don't want to hear anymore, and they push Paul away. But again, it's interesting, sometimes conviction lasts for a period of time, and then who knows what happens. But nevertheless, we don't know anything more about Felix, but it is kind of intriguing to see that he asked for a private meeting in the side of heaven. Who knows what actually came of it as well. And it does at least show Felix interest, but even there, it's interesting because it talks about the fact in verse 26, he hoped that money would be given to him by Paul. Does this sound like another politician or two? You've always heard about politicians. He's looking for a bribe. And so maybe he's getting together for, you know, mixed motives, to put it mildly. But again, Paul's not going to bribe his way out of that legal situation. And so basically the account just ends in chapter 24, and verses 26 to 27, with him just simply staying in prison until the next governor comes in. And I thought what it was interesting is, as I put down on the screen here, notice that Felix, as a governor, you know, is a man more easily swayed by the opinions and reactions from others than by the gospel message of sin and salvation. You know, if you think that's only happened in the 20th or 21st century, you see that happening right there in the first century as well. So let's move on. And now what you have to do is recognize now we've got a fairly significant amount of time that transpires between 24 and 25. But again, the kind of the theme that runs through this is that believers should preach the gospel when they're treated unfairly. I mean, at this point, Paul's got to feel like, okay, I guess I'm going to go through what Joseph went through. I'm in prison. It's not as bad, obviously. As a matter of fact, there's an indication here that he was allowed to keep his freedom. He was allowed to have his friends come and minister to him. So it's more like he's under house arrest. But still, he's got to say, you know, there's so many places I want to go, so many churches I want to plant, so many churches that are already planted that I want to minister to, and I'm stuck here in this Roman colony, Caesarea. But nevertheless, that's where he finds himself. And so then we now see that Felix is succeeded by a new governor called Festus. And in no time now, the Jews return again. This is 2 years later. You know, it just shows you that sometimes when people are angry with Paul, 2 years doesn't tamp down the anger. They're just waiting for some kind of justice. And so now they're coming back with their accusations. These are now 2 years old against Paul. And actually what they're suggesting in verses 1-3 here is that they urged him, asking that they just simply allow him to release him so that they can kill him. So it's pretty obvious that this is a dangerous time for Paul, and maybe he's safer by being in Caesarea. And so again, Festus invites the Jews to participate in a more legal course of action and reopens his case. If you've ever been in a law situation, a lawsuit, and it takes 2 years, maybe you can get some comfort recognizing Paul's just basically twiddling his thumbs, maybe ministering to and ministering to some, preaching to some, but by and large, just kind of stuck there for 2 years. And again, we see how Festus is very much like Felix. His desire is to have a good standing among the Jewish population, and that's really stronger than his desire to uphold justice. And instead of dismissing the case, after he hears that, look at verse 9 here, he says, well, maybe we can then send you back to Jerusalem. Paul at this point is like the proverbial hot potato. Can we just simply pass it on to somebody else? And at this point, then, I think Paul plays the card, the trump card, the ace card, whatever you want to call it. And that is, I'm a Roman citizen. If you can't release me, then I want to appear before a Roman court in front of Caesar to plead my case. And at that point, then it really is sort of out of the hands of Festus, and that's what he has to go along with. And so while Paul waits for this transfer, that now is going to take from Rome. He will get on a ship from Caesarea, head towards Rome. Of course, there's going to be a shipwreck in Malta, which we'll talk about next week. And we'll even, if we have a little bit of time, show a little bit of that wonderful investigative story, which suggests that maybe indeed we've discovered the anchors of Paul in Malta, which is very fascinating. We'll talk more about that next week. He's still waiting, and now a king comes, and this is King Agrippa. And so the governor informs the king of all that has transpired over the last couple of years. You can see that in verses 14 to 21. And although most of the account is accurate, what he says, he doesn't really say anything about his timidity, about his desire to actually keep the case going rather than dismiss it. Instead, he claims to have a sincere interest in the pursuit of justice by sending Paul back to Jerusalem for more questioning. Again, isn't it interesting? You sometimes think, we just have these crooked politicians in the 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st century. You see that right there. Nobody's willing to take a stand, and Paul finds himself at the mercy of these individuals, whether it's Festus or Felix, who just simply won't do the right thing, and his case has festered now for more than 2 years. And so, if nothing else, of course, we can see, as I put on the screen here, the case by this time has become kind of a joke. Each politician had a chance to act justly by deciding in Paul's favor, but each are swayed by their desire for self-preservation. And this is further confirmed by Festus, who claims to have arrived at the conclusion about Paul's innocence, but then we wonder why Festus is not actually allowed Paul to go free. And so we carry that to the end of chapter 25. And so then from chapters 26 and 7, we'll see the actual defense that Paul gives before King Agrippa next week in chapter 26. And then we're going to put him on a ship and we're going to go to Malta. And if we have enough time, we'll talk about the anchors of Paul, which I think will be a great opportunity. And any of you that would like to read ahead or see that, just type in the names Bob Cornuke. I think there's a YouTube video right now, or the Anchors of Paul, and we'll spend some time talking about another interesting archaeological find that correlates with some of the things that we find there as well. But let me, if I can, for just a minute, since we're talking about Rome, and we'll end somewhat early because I know we've got some meetings here, talk about this very important question, and that is, are we Rome? I'm going to, first of all, talk about this book, which is a secular book. I'm not necessarily recommending it, but it came out a number of years ago by Colin Murphy. And what I thought was so intriguing is that he really said that what we see in America are some of similarities and some differences, but maybe a warning that the United States needs to pay attention to the fact that nations rise and nations fall. And are we at a point in which there might be a fall someday of the American Empire? Now, you got to understand, Colin Murphy writes a lot for the Atlantic. He is a kind of a liberal, secular progressive. So that gives you a little bit of an idea. And the book came out when George W. Bush was president. And so as you read through there, you see he's got kind of an agenda. You know, here we have this cowboy in office who is engaged in military actions in Iraq and Afghanistan that believes in American exceptionalism. This is really dangerous stuff. Well, I even did a week of radio programs on this later, but I did them when we had another president in office, Barack Obama. And I often thought if he ever heard the program or saw it, he would have been all upset because, you know, I'm sure he was a real Obama supporter. But, you know, the point is whether you look at who the president is or what the culture is, I've oftentimes said the culture is upstream from politics. In some respects, I think he was really accurate, but he's more willing to, I think, talk about some of our very significant issues in America when the person in the Oval Office was somebody he disliked. I was wondering if the same book would have come out when the person who was in the Oval Office he liked. But nevertheless, he talks about some of the major similarities and differences between the Roman Empire and America. Size, political dominance, global influence, but of course also differs in terms of technology technology, government, slavery, democracy, entrepreneurship, and some of that, and see some of those parallels. So for just a minute, I'm going to go through these fairly quickly, but again, don't forget, this is on the website if you'd like to look at it more in the future, because let's look at some of the similarities, and I use some quotes from the book. So again, I'm giving you a book report. You don't have to read the book. I'm going to give you everything you need to know if you'd like. But first of all, he points out that there are some really striking similarities between Rome and America. Rome and America, he said, are the most powerful actors in their world. By many orders of magnitude, their power includes both military might and the soft power of language, culture, commerce, technology, and ideas. So in some respects, you can go anywhere in the world and you can see the influence of America. It could be something as simple as the fact that you go down a street, even in a third world country, and there's a McDonald's or there's a Starbucks. Or the fact is that if they know their native language, most of them, if they want to succeed, also have learned English. It is amazing. Wherever I travel, even though I may not be able to speak that language, especially when we go to Hungary, there is actually no motivation for me to learn Hungarian, since only people in Hungary and a few people in Romania speak Hungarian. The fortunate is that they all speak English anyway. You know, it's just in many countries. I know when Suzanne and I were in the Philippines, they said, your key to success in the Philippines is to learn English. If all you know is Tagalog, you're not going to be very successful. So you can see how, in some respects, Rome covered the Western world, and in a sense, America's covered the world as well. Approximately equal in size. Never thought about that before, but Rome and America are comparable in physical size. The Roman Empire and its Mediterranean lake would fit inside the 3 million square miles of the lower 48 states. So there's some similarity in size. Global influence, I sort of already alluded to that a little bit. He says both Rome and America created global structures, administrative, economic, military, and cultural, that the rest of the world and their own citizens came to take for granted, as gravity and photosynthesis have taken for granted. Where's the United Nations? It's in New York. You know, where is the International Monetary Fund? Started and Bretton Woods right there in New Hampshire. So, I mean, you can get to see that the influence of America or the influence of Rome because of these global structures. Also, an open society. Both societies made up of many peoples, open to newcomers, willing to absorb the genes and lifestyles and gods of everyone else, and to grant citizenship to incoming tribes. But that was kind of interesting to see some of those similarities as well. And one more, and then I'll talk about some of the differences. Culturally similar. I thought this was interesting. Romans and Americans can't get enough of laws and lawyers and lawsuits. They relish the ritual humiliation of public figures. Recognize he wrote this before the current president was in office, who seems almost every day we talk about something in regard there. Americans through comedy and satire, talk radio, court TV. The Romans through vicious satire, to be sure, but also through the means of what was called centuria nota. That was the idea of the public airing, name by name, of everything great men of the time should be ashamed of. Does that sound familiar? I mean, in some respects, that part of the book and section even has become more relevant here in 2018. So those are some similarities, but some real striking differences as well. First of all, technological advances. I love what he says. Rome, in all its long history, never left the Iron Age, whereas America, in its short history, has already left through the Industrial Age to the Information Age and the Biotech Age. And that's kind of striking as we talk about Rome in the next couple of weeks here, to recognize that in some respects Rome was a sort of a brutal empire, but we don't see a great deal of innovation. We don't see a great deal of entrepreneurship. I'm going to say more about that in just a minute. And so in some respects it suffered under its domination that prevented the human spirit from being creative. Abundance. Wealthy as it was, Rome lived close to the edge. Many regions were one dry season away from famine, whereas America enjoys an economy of abundance, even surfeit. It must be aware of the dangers and diseases of overindulgence, because we enjoy tremendous blessings in terms of material wealth, in terms of all the food that we eat, in terms of all the devices we own, and all the rest. A couple more. An obvious difference is slavery, because Rome succeeded on the backs of slaves. It's amazing the estimates. It could have been in some places 3 out of every 4 individuals in some of these outposts were slaves. Other places maybe a little bit less, depends on where you were. And I'm going to say more about that in just a minute when I quote from a book by Rodney Stark, which is another book I'm going to recommend in just a minute. But again, Rome was always a slaveholding polity with a profound moral and social retardation that implies. By contrast, America started out as a slaveholding polity and decisively cast slavery aside. We talk about government. This is interesting as well. Rome emerged out of a city-state and took centuries to go out of a city-state method of governments, whereas America, almost from its beginning, saw itself as a continental power. And a few more real quickly. Middle class. Rome had no middle class as we understand the term, whereas America, the middle class is the foundation of our republic. Entrepreneurship. Romans looked down on entrepreneurship and inventions and capital investment and work, whereas Americans hold entrepreneurship in the highest value. And then economic dynamism. Rome was economically static. America is economically transformative. And so those are some of those differences. And so in some respects, you can say, yes, there are some similarities between Rome and the United States. But what I wanted to do real quickly is mention another book, which I think very highly of. And it's a book by Professor Glenn Sunshine. I met him when I had a chance. Suzanne and I were in Connecticut a while back, and I was speaking in his church. Turns out that, interestingly enough, he attends the church that Jonathan Edwards went to when he was a student at Yale College. As a matter of fact, I got a chance to preach from that pulpit, which is a pulpit where you climb up, you know, and it's just one of those elevated pulpits. And that pulpit's been there so long that I was wondering if one of the pieces of the wood would fall through when I get up to that pulpit. But nevertheless, and by the way, that church has been there a long time, but it's the third church that's been on that grounds. The first two were burned down by the Indians. So that's how long that church has been there. But nevertheless, Glenn Sunshine is not only a member of that church, but also is the head of the history department at Central Connecticut University. And he was giving a lecture about Jonathan Edwards' worldview at a conference, and lo and behold, who was in attendance? Chuck Colson. And Chuck Colson said, "You're a Christian with tremendous historical background. I want you to come and help us out." And so he's part of the Centurion program and has been very much tied to what indeed Chuck Colson and now Breakpoint and the Colson Center have been doing for now decades. And after a while, he gave a whole series of talks about how worldviews change over time. And so they asked him to write this book. And this is a book called Why You Think the Way You Do, Worldviews from Rome to Home. But I think he answers a question that our other secular historian never really understood. And that is this. He begins his book by talking about the worldview of Rome, and by the end of his book, he returns to the same worldview. His premise is this: Roman culture plus Christianity gave us Western civilization. In other words, you want to say Western civilization equals Rome plus Christianity. It's when Christianity came into the Roman world that it gave us Western culture. And so he argues that once you remove Christianity from Western culture, we go back to the worldview of what? Rome. Now, if you buy that argument, and he makes a very compelling case, it's very reminiscent of a very famous quote that has been attributed to Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens. So, I don't think he said it because nobody's ever to find it, but supposedly Mark Twain said, "History does not repeat, but it rhymes." And that's a way of saying that history doesn't necessarily come back. We're not like Eastern mystics that believe that, we're going through history and it's cyclical, but there is a sense in which we find ourselves as Christians in the 21st century in a world very similar to the world we've been reading about in the first century. Does that make sense? I think it does. In some respects, our world is more like Rome and more like the pagan Rome culture than any world in any century after it. And so we find ourselves in a situation very much like that. Now, if you accept that, it's kind of intriguing because he says, again, look at the parallels that he sees cities in the book. He says, like Rome, we value toleration as a supreme virtue. We lived in a culture where we believed in truth with a capital T. Not so much now. We believe in another word with a capital T, and it's what? Tolerance. You know, dare to say anything that would be perceived as what? Intolerant. And you get marginalized very quickly, don't you? So that's interesting. The Romans lived in an oversexed society. So was ours. Rome practiced abortion. So does our society. As a matter of fact, Rome made a deliberate attempt to prevent pregnancy. It was antinatalist in many ways. And if you look in our modern world, the birth rates of most of the Western democracies are plummeting. Even this week, one of the things I talked about on the radio program, we had an article that's come out just talking about these declining birth rates, not only in Europe, but now even in the United States. You know, you wouldn't know that at Preston, would you? Because you got kind of a bimodal thing, you know, the declining birth rate for secularists and almost the increasing birth rate for the Christians. You know, have you noticed how crowded it is over there? You know, when we're with our kids. So the Christians are still having babies. Matter of fact, this is causing a lot of liberals to talk about what they call the birth gap. Because Christians have more babies than secularists. Conservatives have more babies than liberals. You play that out over generations, you're going to have a lot more conservatives, a lot more Christians. If it weren't for the fact that universities are actually doing a very good job of trying to convert them back. But nevertheless, it's kind of an intriguing kind of phenomenon. But again, you see that as a parallel between Rome and the United States. What about the Christian influence? How did this develop? Well, again, he talks about the fact that as Christian ideas began to flow through the Roman culture, it changed everything. We're already starting to see a little of this in the book of Acts, but let's continue past the book of Acts, in which, for example, one of the most important ideas early on in this whole idea of the Roman Empire was this idea that people are created in the image of God. Well, the impact that that almost instantaneously meant that people were fundamentally equal to one another. And if nothing else, that was ultimately the death knell to this idea of slavery. Matter of fact, lots of the early converts to Christianity were what? Slaves. Because they were essentially property. They were non-people. And to come and to say, no, you have a spark of God in you as well, was profound. And he writes, and I'm quoting again from Glenn Sunshine, Christians were the first people in history to oppose slavery systematically. Well, more than that, Christians who also believed that we're created in the image of God treated the sick differently. They believed that even those who were deathly ill still deserved care. And one of the quotes he has in there is from Dionysius of Alexandria, who reported that Christians, often at great risk to their own lives, visited the sick fearlessly and ministered to them continually. What was the tradition in Rome? If you had somebody who was sick, they would be left out on the streets. If somebody was defective, a child was born defective, they would be allowed to die out on the streets. That was the way you dealt with all of those issues. This idea of compassion, come meaning with, compassion, having to passion with, was a Christian idea. And so they would then go out and rescue those babies that had been abandoned in the streets. They would go out there and oppose abortion. And you see some of that also documented as well. We see this in economics. It began to change a view because we see the influence of Christianity because they believe that God created the universe and then God rested that after that, if God rested, that means God worked. That would mean that human beings created in God's image were expected to work. We take that for granted today in the Western culture, but in Rome, physical work was something which was demeaning. Work was to be done by what? Slaves. This was not something that a Roman citizen would do, and so they did not see labor and work as valuable, whereas Christians saw labor as something that was intrinsically valuable. At the same time, here's something else that's intriguing about this. They recognize that labor is good, drudgery is bad. Why do we have drudgery? Because of the fall, Genesis 3. So Christians were the first to develop technology to remove drudgery from work. And he points out in the book here that other civilizations had technologies. Don't get us wrong. We're not saying that Christians invented technology. The Chinese had technology. Various Asia Minor technologies had technology of some sort. Lots of times the technology was used to be more effective in fighting war. But nevertheless, they had technology. But in the West, they uniquely applied such things as water power to make work valuable, but also to actually remove the drudgery and repetitive nature of certain tasks. So again, you can see how in so many different ways this Christian worldview had now begun to transform the Roman world. Well, if nothing else, I thought it would be kind of intriguing to end with some of these statements, because Glenn Sunshine argues that once you remove Christianity from modern society, we sort of reverted back to a Roman society and an ancient pagan worldview. So how should Christians live out in this world? Well, I should think we should live out a biblical worldview just like these first century Christians we've been learning about. Every generation is called to live faithfully to the gospel, and our generation is no exception. Now, we face, in some respects, the same kind of challenge as the early church, although not as daunting. I mean, we have seminaries, we have media, we have churches, we have all sorts of things that allow us. But again, we should recognize that the early church faithfully lived this out, and they transformed the Roman world. By the 3rd or 4th century, you have almost a Christianized Roman society because of the influence of the Christians, and they produced a totally new civilization, which today we call what? Western civilization. We will increase our credibility and earn the respect of those around us by living according to those same biblical values. So whether you look at Acts or whether you look at some of these books, these are great resources. And let me just mention real quickly some of the resources that I thought I might mention. First of all, the book by Glenn Sunshine, Why You Think the Way You Do, Worldviews from Rome to Home. So if you wanted to read a very interesting Christian book on that, that would be the case. But I thought I'd also mention, I've mentioned him before, Rodney Stark. He's a professor at Baylor University, has written this book, and he's written quite a number of books, but this one is the one that's received so many awards, called The Triumph of Christianity. And it just reminds us again of what it was like to live in Rome. And I thought I'd just read one passage, since I got a minute or two left, about what it was like just to have very little water, and what it was like to even live in Rome itself. He said, soap had not yet been invented because water had to be carried home in jugs from public fountains. There could have been very little water for scrubbing floors or washing clothes, nor could there have been much for bathing, although many people go to public baths. But even at the baths, the water was quite contaminated because whether it came to a city by way of an aqueduct or from local wells, all the larger Greco-Roman cities had to store water in cisterns awaiting use, and untreated water, when left stagnant, encouraged the growth of algae and other organisms, rendered the water malodious, unpalatable, and after a time, undrinkable. When you turn on your water faucet today, think of this passage. Pliny, the younger, the historian, advised that all water is the better for having been boiled. Just think of what you'd have to do every single day. One thing is certain, when human density is high, urgent problems of sanitation arise. Granted that an underground sewer carried water from major baths of Rome through public latrines next door in and out of the city to be dumped untreated into the Tiber River, which could therefore be smelled for many miles. But few people jogged off to public latrines each time nature called. Like all cities until very modern times, people used chamber pots and pit latrines, and for lack of open spaces, most Greco-Roman cities were entirely dependent on pots. Of course, pots needed to be emptied, and often the only way was to dump them in open ditches running throughout the streets that served as sewers. Too often the pots were emptied out of upper story windows at night, and here's a story about what it might have been like to walk under one of those when somebody throws them out. And story after story after story talks about how filthy it was to live in a place like Rome, and then has whole chapters here on how at night the Christians would go out into the cities in the midst of this looking for any child that might have been left out on the streets to rescue them. And how they would go, and when there was a plague, they would go out there and they would risk their own lives to treat people who had the plague, because they believed that ultimately their destiny was not on earth, but it was in heaven. And because of that, Christians literally turned the world around. Today, we were challenged by the pastor to go and fight for the family. Let me just extend that to say, fight for the gospel. A ragtag bunch of Christians in the first century literally turned the Roman Empire upside down. Could we, as Christians today, make a positive influence in our culture? I think that we can.